Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. Anyone who is standing may be seated. And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is State versus Figueres. And we will begin by introducing members of the court and then recognizing counsel. I am Mike Havikin, and I am the Chief Justice. And now by seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
I am Jeff Funk. Good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan Papik.
And John Friedenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Mr. Bartling, are you with us this morning?
Good morning, Judge. Yes, I am.
Good morning to you. And Mr. Ralph, are you with us this morning?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No.
Sir.
Both sides have up to 20 minutes to argue. With that, Mr. Bartling, again, good morning, and you may proceed.
Thank you. May I ask that there be 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal, please?
You may. Thank you.
May it please the court, the story of State versus Philip Figueres is the story of a fight to receive a fair trial. The context of this fight took place in Douglas County, Nebraska, and arose related to charges of murder in the first degree and use of a weapon to commit a felony. Mr. Figueres is here today before this court to assert that he did not receive a fair trial. And the reason that he did not receive a fair trial fall largely into three categories. One is the trial court did not follow Nebraska law. Two is the trial court at multiple stages of the proceedings created non-legal standards and applied them to Mr. Figueres. And three, Mr. Figueres received ineffective assistance of counsel. Mr. Figueres' brief sets forth these arguments in great detail. I will not have the opportunity to discuss each one of these arguments today in full. We will discuss a few and submit the rest on the written argument. The first argument that Mr. Figueres wishes to present to the court is the argument involving the effective receipt of Sixth Amendment services as distinguished from ineffective assistance of counsel. To begin with, Mr. Figueres is indigent. The District Court for Douglas County entered an order confirming that. It's axiomatic in our system that an indigent defendant receive an attorney, and that attorney be more than mere window dressing. The integrity of the system depends on each side having a zealous advocate at all stages of the proceedings, not merely at the trial stage. When it's broken down in respect to Mr. Figueres' case, we see obviously and repeatedly from the record a breakdown in the advocacy relationship that Mr. Figueres had with trial counsel and with trial co-counsel. And not only was the relationship broken, but the direct product of that relationship was that Mr. Figueres suffered. And along with Mr. Figueres suffering, the integrity of the system that the Sixth Amendment is in place to protect suffered. Now, the record reflects the breakdown at many stages. The breakdown starts 2 days prior to the appointment of counsel. In September of 2018, Mr. Figueres' court-appointed counsel moved to withdraw prior to his appointment. Counsel indicated to the court he could not serve Mr. Figueres. He was generic in his pleading, but the court held a hearing on that. And at the court, at the hearing, the court applied the appropriate test. And that test was Mr. Figures could waive counsel and proceed pro se. He could demonstrate, if he could, that his counsel was incompetent, or he could retain counsel. The third of those prongs is out the window right away. Mr. Figures was indigent. He was incarcerated. He had no ability to retain private counsel. He was also charged with what was repeatedly described in pleadings and the record as a complex and serious matter. So the suggestion that he proceed pro se is, again, window dressing. His counsel, over the course of time between September 2018 and July of 2019, a 10-month period of time, moved to withdraw on multiple occasions. Mr. Figures filed numerous documents with the court pro se that did not advocate in terms of pleadings. They delineated in terms of his complaints. Now, the district court believed that Mr. Figures had established and counsel had established a substantial complaint about counsel pursuant to State versus Davlin, and the court held repeated hearings involving Mr. Figures. Each one of those hearings, the court concluded that Mr. Figures was making a mere complaint of dissatisfaction about his counsel. At other hearings, the court enforced an elevated standard that is not recognized in Nebraska law, and that is, instead of asking Mr. Figures to show good cause for the appointment of successor counsel, the court imposed the standard of exceptional circumstances and stated to Mr. Figures on more than one occasion, "Sir, you have not shown exceptional circumstances to warrant change of counsel." I would suggest to this court that this is a problem for Mr. Figures and for this record, because the grounds that Mr. Figures asserted at each stage were unrefuted. Not only were they unrefuted by the state, they were unrefuted by trial counsel. It is obvious in reading this record and studying this dynamic that Mr. Figures and trial counsel had no working relationship. And specifically, Mr. Figures delineated to the court, both in writing and orally, evidence, witnesses, and other investigatory matters that he wished counsel to pursue that did not occur. We know those didn't occur, not only because of Mr. Figures' statements, but because the trial record reflects that they did not occur. One example, and only one example, is that Mr. Figures wished to call several witnesses as an alibi witness. Those witnesses were identified, never called. From the standpoint of Mr. Figures, he expressed much more than mere dissatisfaction. He expressed a systemic breakdown in his relationship with counsel that affected his ability to receive effective Sixth Amendment services, and as a result of that, affected the fairness of the proceeding. With respect to a interwoven issue with Mr. Figures' representation, the dysfunction that he shared with trial counsel manifested itself in his request to the court on multiple occasions to review discovery material. He requested that material as an effort to prepare himself for trial. Also, the court at many hearings invited him to proceed pro se. So in addition to preparing himself for trial, it is reasonable to believe that Mr. Figures would need to review that material in order to determine if he could proceed pro se. And once again, in this context, as delineated in our brief, rather than follow Nebraska law, the court deferred to the state and said the state has a, quote, generous policy of discovery. And as a result of that generous policy, even though the court sustained Mr. Figures' motion for discovery pursuant to Nebraska statute, the court declined to give him materials to review to prepare for trial. And even though the court—
Counsel, there a discovery order entered in this case?
Yes, there was, Judge.
Were there any receipts or acknowledgments from Mr. Figures that they received those documents?
Let me take half a step back. On February 15th, 2019, the defendant filed a the document called the motion, defendant's motion for discovery. On March 20th, 2019, the court issued something called Order Re Discovery and Depositions. It sustained the motion, and the language the court used was ordering discovery pursuant to defendant's motion. In other words,
was that motion pursuant to statute that asked for the items set forth in Nebraska statute?
It was a short, more cursory style pleading, Judge. It did ask pursuant to statute, but it wasn't highly specified.
Okay. Was there any indication in the file, the record, that that was complied with? Was there any receipts or acknowledgments of receiving discovery?
It is not in the record. It is something I think the court can make a reasonable inference about, that trial counsel received discovery. Mr. Figure's pleadings indicate that. Trial counsel indicates that, and trial counsel states to the trial judge at least one hearing on this topic, Judge, I have the materials and I could provide them to Mr. Figures with the court's permission.
So,
but there is no return receipt.
You reference Nebraska law requiring discovery. What Nebraska law are you referring to? And does that deal with the initial discovery given to defense counsel, or is there additional law that deals with giving a separate set of documents to Mr. Figures himself?
Judge, in the brief, we talk about generic Nebraska law referring to discovery, chapter 29 discovery. The challenge here for Mr. Figures, and that's why I just use the term interwoven, is that Mr. Figures does not appear to have received any meaningful ongoing communication with counsel based on the documents in the record, and that lack of communication includes a lack of review of discovery. And I acknowledge traditionally the way discovery is disseminated to a criminal defendant is through counsel. However, this case presented a unique circumstance because the trial judge asked Mr. Figures if he would like to proceed pro se, and Mr. Figures stated on the record that would be dumb. This is a murder case. That's what he said. And I think we can reasonably infer from that statement by Mr. Figures that the complexity of the case was such that if he hadn't reviewed his materials, he would have no ability to make a meaningful answer to the trial judge's question.
You just had referenced Nebraska law, and I didn't know if there was something more specific that I wasn't familiar with regarding additional discovery being given to the defendant independently of given to defense counsel. So I apologize. I didn't mean to take you off track.
Oh, no problem. And your understanding of Mr. Figure's argument is correct. Yes. Again, in this context, to summarize, it's Mr. Figure's belief that when he availed himself to the court to seek relief that he's entitled to receive, the court once again applied a standard that wasn't an appropriate standard under Nebraska law. Instead of looking at the statute and determining whether he had the ability to have this, the court simply said the state has been generous, the state provides more than it needs to, and therefore you don't get your discovery. The next topic Mr. Figures would like to address within this context is the dismissal of the only African-American juror on this jury. Following the court's swearing of the jury, the state moved to dismiss the only African-American juror. And it needs to be noted on the record that Mr. Figures is African-American. And this was the only member of his cultural background that was in the 12-person body. As the court knows under State versus Thomas, it's the moving party's burden to demonstrate that a juror should be disqualified after sworn. And traditionally, the standard for review is whether the juror has shown bias, engaged in misconduct, or shown an otherwise inability to serve. The court held a hearing, although it did not swear witnesses in, and took testimony from the juror in question, as well as two other people. One of those persons was the sister of the victim of the homicide, and another was a person that had a general association with the case. Regardless of any potential bias of those folks, the court did not receive any information indicating that this juror had any inappropriate contact, had any inability to serve, had engaged in misconduct, or had demonstrated bias. The conversation simply was, that a person that the state believed was associated with Mr. Figures, there was no evidence of that, went to this juror as the juror was leaving the court house, and at that time engaged in a very brief conversation, at which time the juror went her separate way. When the juror explained this to the trial judge, the juror said, "I thought this person was hitting on me. I was on my telephone the entire time. I was texting another individual, and I didn't want anything to do with that."
Did the juror, give two different versions of events, or just one?
One version of events. I take issue with the idea that there were two versions. The juror provided a statement to the trial judge in front of counsel. Then on her own, the juror notified the court that she wished to make an additional statement. When she returned to the courtroom, she said, "After I left, after you excused me, I realized that someone had talked to me and I thought the person was hitting on me. The person did not discuss this case, so I didn't think that's what you were discussing." Now, the trial judge very clearly interpreted that as a conflict in statements. And the trial judge stated very clearly on the record, "Ma'am, I gave you the opportunity to tell me what happened and you didn't, you couldn't remember what happened." But I don't think the record reflects that. And even if the record reflects that the witness forgot part of what happened on the first instance, the witness on her own returned to the court and shared that information with the court and all the parties. And even if there is some inconsistency there, the inconsistency was never about bias, it was never about misconduct, and it was never about an inability to serve. The witness—
What is our standard of review as to what the judge did there?
Standard of review for that issue, Judge, is abuse of discretion. And the suggestion here by Mr. Figures, a very strong suggestion, is that the trial court abused its discretion by discharging the juror because the state had not met its burden of proof. The state didn't even elicit any evidence. There was a talking conversation at which the state presented its own point of view in the form of a quasi offer of proof, which wasn't an offer of proof. They made declarative statements that the court accepted as true without allowing defense to cross those statements or bring in witnesses. And the state's two witnesses, Ms. Watt and Mr. Dennard, who were not the jury in question, those folks both said unequivocally they didn't know what happened. It could have been innocent. The juror's body language cut the other person off. It appeared to be very consistent with the juror's statement. And the problem is—
credibility determination?
Is that a credibility determination?
Yes.
Certainly the judge is within his realm to assess the credibility of those witnesses, yes.
And what deference do we give to a trial court's determination of credibility?
Well, in this context, the court needs to view any deference that you give in light of your standard. So reasonable deference is the standard that this court traditionally gives, or more than reasonable deference, when it comes to assessing trial testimony. This is not trial testimony. This is a disqualification event based on a specific standard. And this court needs to look at the record to determine whether that specific standard was met. If a witness told 90% of an event, and then on her own came back and said, "I remember the other 10% of the event," that's not an automatic disqualification for lack of credibility. It may be yes, sir.
What's the legal relevance of the disqualified juror's racial background?
Well, the legal relevance is that trial counsel made a Batson objection and indicated that this juror was on the jury. The state did not disqualify this juror for a legitimate reason at the outset of the trial. And then later on, knowing what they knew in their offer of proof prior to the trial, raised that issue again based on what amounts to a spurious claim that this juror had engaged in misconduct. The juror had not engaged in misconduct. The juror simply was leaving the courthouse on her phone when someone approached her. She brushed the person off And that shouldn't have been a disqualification for Mr. Figures. He's entitled to a jury that's made up of a composition of folks who are of his race and his background. And there was one of those people on the jury, and that person was kicked off the jury for reasons that are evidentially insufficient. And
this isn't a peremptory strike situation like in Batson. I mean, I understand you disagree that there was cause, but this juror was disqualified for cause, correct?
Correct.
To summarize, what was the cause? What was the explanation for excusing this juror after the trial commenced?
The explanation that was given by the trial judge, you'll find that at roughly pages 1096 of the Bill of Exceptions, the court states to the juror, I exhausted her memory about everything that may have happened between her and some other party, and she repeatedly denied there was. I gave plenty of opportunity, so I'm going to sustain the state's motion. And that's on page 1096, line 23 through 1097, line 8. That's the explanation.
How are we to understand that? That the cause was she had inconsistent memory?
I think you have to read the record just as I did and infer that the judge did not believe that when she returned to the courtroom to augment her statement, that was something that she couldn't have said beforehand. It doesn't go to any of the standards, and that's one of the problems, and that's a continuing theme for Mr. Figures, is he's availed himself to the legal standards, whether they're the Sixth Amendment, Nebraska statutes, or case law, and at every opportunity, he's not allowed to use that. I have 9 seconds left, and I just want to say on behalf of Mr. Figures that he is asking and inviting this court to revisit exception that this court has carved out to 27-4042 with respect to intrinsically intertwined evidence. That argument is delineated in full in the brief, but for the reasons set forth therein, he does invite this court to review that and change course on that matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
Good morning. And everybody can hear me, right? Okay.
Yes.
May it please the court. My name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. I'll follow Mr. Bartling's lead and sort of focus on the same issues, those being the motions to withdraw or allow his counsel to withdraw, the discovery issue, and then the discharge of the juror. On the motions to withdraw, I think the framework is pretty well established, essentially that the right of an indigent defendant to have counsel does not give him the right to be represented by counsel of his choosing. And the language basically is that mere distrust or dissatisfaction is not enough. You have to show good cause to warrant a substitute counsel. And as I said in my brief, I'll address first the correctness of the standard or the proper standard used. The district court did use the term exceptional circumstances at times, specifically in the second hearing. But as I read it, and I think if your honors read it in context, the district court was just using what it considered to be a synonym. It used the term exceptional circumstances to mean good cause. He used them interchangeably. And I think that's supported by the record, specifically toward the end, the district court specifically finds that there was no good cause. And if you read it in light of the first hearing where the district court referred to the good cause standard, I think it's clear that the appropriate standard was applied. And in our view, as I said in my brief, I think the reasons offered by the defendant did amount to basically your dissatisfaction or distrust. The first motion and the first hearing, he talked about having, you know, a couple disagreements, that the attorney was never, you know, my attorney. He didn't feel comfortable working with his appointed counsel. He wanted someone with more experience in murder trials. And then in the second hearing and motion, several motions, I think he sort of built on that foundation of I don't have a working, trusting relationship with this attorney. I want someone with more experience. All of that amounted to, in our view, just mere distrust or mere dissatisfaction. The district court at the second hearing, after hearing from the defendant, specifically asked him, and suffice it to say, I think just to summarize all the points you just made in the record, you're not satisfied with your attorneys. And Figures replied, no, Your Honor. And then I think when he asked for substitute counsel, the primary focus is, I want somebody with more experience in murder trials, and I want somebody who wants to be lead attorney, both of which, again, we think amount to just dissatisfaction or distrust. So in our view, again, considering the record as well as the standard overview, we don't think the district court abused its discretion in denying those motions for substitute counsel. Moving to the discovery issue, I think the record, it's not maybe fully substantiated as it should have been, but it seems like the record shows that the defense counsel and the prosecutor's office had some sort of agreement, a local practice where the defendant, accepts discovery in excess of what 25-19-12 requires, and in exchange will not give physical copies to the defendant to keep in prison or jail. I don't see anything in 19-12 or any other law that I'm aware of that would prohibit such an agreement. It doesn't prevent or preclude the defendant from preparing for trial. He's still able to review the discovery with counsel. I think there are instances in the record that show that happened, specifically as well as far as, I have it here, the June 20th hearing, 2019, counsel talks about that relationship. He's glad to say at this point it's significantly improved. He was able to have some meetings with the defendant, and so it didn't prevent the defendant from helping with his defense or reviewing discovery, and I don't think it's an abuse of discretion on the part of district court to accept or basically enforce an agreement between defense counsel and the prosecutor's office as to the copies not being
counsel. Is there anything in the record as to why this local custom exists?
Well, like I said, the record is kind of sparse on it. I think the implication from what the prosecutor said, it's like two or three lines, really, page, I think, 30 of the record, basically that they give more than what is required under 1912 as sort of an incentive for the defense counsel not to provide copies. Things like, police reports are not required under 1912. Those are generally provided. I guess to answer your question, the reason for the practice, I think, is basically it is of some benefit to both sides. Defendant gets more information than he otherwise would, and the prosecution keeps discovery documents, physical copies of documents, out of prisons. And so I don't see an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court considering that evidence, considering also that defense counsel is acting as the agent for the defendant to basically enforce that agreement. And I don't see any due process violation when, again, it's the defendant's counsel, his agent, doing this, as well as the fact that he's still able to prepare for his defense and review discovery with counsel. Excuse me.
Would you say then under this custom it is effectively a stipulation between the state?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you cut out there.
I beg your pardon. Can you hear me now, sir?
Yes, I can.
Would you say that this custom is essentially a stipulation between the parties, or counsel rather, that the state will provide information perhaps in excess of its statutory obligation if counsel agrees not to give the materials to the defendant who is incarcerated?
That seems to be the what the record suggests. Like I said, it was pretty sparse. I don't have anything beyond what the record says, but yes, I think that is correct. That would be a correct characterization of it.
Thank you. And then I did have another question, if I may, and that is, after the June 20th hearing, were there other motions to withdraw after June 20?
You know, I'd have to look. I think in the transcript, the actual motions to withdraw October are in transcript page 34 on the part of the defendant, that is, in transcript page 94, which would have been in March of 2019. So I don't think there was additional motions on the part of the defendant for his counsel to withdraw. He did, however, offer numerous filings after, which he said to the district court, basically he wanted as evidence of prejudice or the reasons that he would want different counsel. But he specifically said, I'm not asking for a ruling on those. And then, so I don't know the exact dates on all of the motions, but I think the majority of them on the defendants were before that June hearing. And then, on the council's motions, I think as well.
Mr. Ralph, is there any suggestion in the record that the defendant was not allowed to inspect any of the discovery materials that were provided? Merely that he simply was not provided a physical copy to keep in his possession of the jail?
That's correct. That's how I read the record. And I cited the relevant provisions and or portions of the record in my brief discussing that. And I think a lot of it was, and this is, I guess, sort of implication from the record, was that the defendant didn't want to cooperate with his counsel. At the end of the first hearing, he specifically asked the district court, what happens if I don't cooperate with my appointed counsel? And the district court said something to the effect of, well, I don't suggest you do that. And then, you know, based on the conversations, I think that was a large part of it. But no, there was nothing preventing him from reviewing the discovery with his counsel. It was just the provision of physical copies that was not allowed. I'll move to the discharge of the juror assigned error. And I think this court laid out the framework in State v. Huff, 2017 decision. It's obviously statutory. 29-2004, I think, controls in this instance, since it's discharge of a juror after the trial has begun. And that version of 29-2004, in effect at the time, basically said, if before the final submission of the cause, a regular juror dies or is discharged, the court shall order the alternate juror basically to take his place. And the statute didn't specify those reasons for, you know, why a juror could be discharged. But I think the case law basically outlines acceptable reasons or acceptable circumstances for substituting an alternate juror for an original juror. And I think that provides or shows that appropriate bases for discharge would include things like bias or misconduct, illness, sleeping, inattentiveness. It's a pretty wide range based on the case law. But the one I think here that I think apply based on the record is that the district court found possible bias or as well as a lack of candor on the part of the juror, which I think are both legitimate justifications to discharge the juror and appoint an alternate. And that was based, I think, in large part on the evidence deduced from the witnesses who said, hey, this guy that she talked to, there was a conversation, is associated with the defendant. And then also the juror's testimony and change in testimony, which I think was at the start, no one ever approached me. She emphasized that numerous times in response to the district court's questions. And then later comes back in and says, you know, on the other hand, someone did approach me. I just, you know, thought he was hitting on me and ignored him. So basically the district court, I think, found a lack of candor, found her not credible. And so on those grounds, discharged the juror, which under these circumstances, I think if you read the record, you will agree was not an abuse of discretion. Unless this court has further questions, I would submit the other issues on the brief, and we would ask this court to affirm the judgment below.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments on State versus Figures. Counsel, we appreciate your participating by WebEx today. You are now excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Brown versus Morello.
Thank you all.
Thank you.